Welcome back, guys. DGS 205. So Andrew was smart enough in my absence over the weekend with my mom to book Jim Talent today to talk about lots of things, but specifically about Israel and Iran. Jim, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it. I'm perfectly willing to be booked when you're the
So it seems crazy to call the launching of hundreds of drones, aircraft, and missiles milquetoast, but it seems from my seat in the bleachers that Iran was very careful to want the credit for doing something, but not to be successful at it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they were setting the information conditions. That's the technical term. In other words, they were doing it in a way that was designed to convince the West to persuade Israel not to respond. Okay. And they seem to have been successful because the G7, I think, including the Biden administration, although they've given different answers to this question, are pressuring Israel not to respond. And if they don't, then Iran will have attacked Israel with 300 projectiles of different kinds on its own soil and have escaped any retribution, which is, of course, what the mullahs are aiming at.
And so I guess in this case, Jim, you could say that everyone can claim victory because the mullahs will certainly claim victory. And but I agree with President Biden on this case, where I understand he said to Netanyahu, take the win. You know, this is the best they can do is they launch 350 things. You knock 349 of them out of the sky before they even get to you. Whatever. Who cares? Move on.
Yeah. Well, do you think Biden should be upset because he told them not to do it and they did it?
Boy, what a
kind of crossing a red line, isn't it?
What a real thorny issue. I mean, whether it's Biden, Trump, Obama, Washington, I mean, this is why people like me don't want to be president. I mean, Lord.
Here's something we could do. There's a number of things we could do, and we'll see if they do them. So one of them is reimpose the sanctions that have been lifted. Refreeze the $10 billion. Reimpose the embargo on selling of missiles. I mean, we've allowed both those to expire in the last couple of months. Reimpose the sanctions on selling oil and really enforce them. Then we could direct CENTCOM to broaden the cooperation, which we saw some of here, so that among different powers, so that we really get an impregnable anti-missile net. Then we could announce that we are supporting Israel unconditionally in its fight against Hamas and will support them if Hezbollah attacks them. And then what we could do is respond to the attacks by Iranian proxies on shipping by taking out the supply lines that Iran has been using to send them the missiles they've been shooting at us. So all those things would be things we could do to impose costs and consequences on Iran, and the Israelis wouldn't have to do anything. So let's see if the administration does it.
So, Jim, over the weekend, I don't know if you saw it or not, but there was an article on Drudge. I kept seeing the headline that America needs to learn to fight again and quickly. What does that mean to you when you read a headline like that? Do you think there's some truth to that?
Yeah, but I think what we need is to prepare to fight and then pursue a policy which assures our adversaries that we will if we have to. Okay, that's the shorthand for that is peace through strength. It's not some brilliancy, you know, that Ronald Reagan thought of. He talked about it a lot. It's the way you deter aggressive powers. In other words, you be ready to respond. And then in policy actions over the years, you make them confident that you will respond. So then when you make a threat, you say, don't do it. They don't do it. Okay. But when, you know, the underlying problem here, I think, Dave, is that the administration has treated Iran like a potential strategic partner when it is actually the strategic threat in the region. And when you make a mistake on that that fundamental level, it almost doesn't matter what you do tactically.
Jim, is that in your estimation, because obviously it's not just Joe Biden sitting there thinking, he's got lots of people around him. In your estimation, is it a well-meaning, honest mistake, or do you think that they are just wishful thinking, that whistling in the graveyard, that they can treat Iran nice and everything's going to go well?
Well, there's history to this. Of course, Obama thought that he could restructure Middle Eastern policy around a security arrangement with Iran, and that if he did that, he could bring peace to the region and we could get out. And Biden was part of that administration, and he brought that back in when he became president. Now, what's working in their minds, I don't know. I do know that just in my time in Washington, leaders in both parties have made mistakes that I just think defied common sense. I was just on balance. We've been very poorly led for a number of years. I do think Trump did much better. He followed a policy of maximum pressure against Iran, took out Qasem Soleimani, which really was a brilliant tactical stroke, and then got the Abraham Accords going, and the Middle East was, for the Middle East, pretty stable. So, again, you got to get the basics right, and I'm afraid Biden hasn't, and it's a very dangerous place, and the Iranians are determined to strike at Israel, Saudi Arabia, and us in any way that they can.
Jim, zooming out, I'm not trying to imply that we are anywhere close to any big red line in the sand where everything's going to blow up. But when it comes to these other actors, these other countries, the ones that are the biggest adversaries, Iran, China, Russia, where is that line where we know if we get to this, it's going to get really bad really fast? Because we haven't gotten to that point in a long, long time as a world where we're all actually engaged. So how far do you have to go before you get to that line?
Well, the first thing to understand is when you have to understand who you're dealing with, okay? And when you're dealing with an aggressive adversary, whether it's Russia, China, Iran, et cetera, if you don't respond when they challenge you because you're afraid of escalation, you have actually encouraged escalation, right?
Yeah.
So let's just take Putin. Let's take it out of the Middle East. So in his first year in office, Biden offered Putin olive leaf after olive leaf. He rolled over the New START nuclear treaty without conditions. He invited him to a summit without conditions. He waived the Nord Stream 2 pipeline sanctions without conditions. And then Putin begins massing troops on the Ukrainian border, and Biden tells him not to do anything, not to invade, right? And he invades. Now, why? It's probably because he didn't think we would respond. I'm sure he felt rather misused when we did respond. And Biden did at least initially respond very effectively there. Now, my fear is that the Chinese are looking at all this and they're saying, the Americans are going to make decisions out of fear. And we can push even harder on Taiwan and they won't do anything. So you see, again, it's not fighting all the time. It's being ready to fight. And then being firm in ways you send the message. You guys remember the Grenada operation under Reagan?
Sure.
Remember that? Okay. So I think the reason President Reagan did that was because it was a completely risk-free way of sending a message that, look, when we're threatened, we will act. As again, it was really brilliant. The same thing when he shot down Muammar Gaddafi's fighters when they intruded other countries' sovereign airspace. He had the Navy shoot him down. He was sending messages that way. And we've been sending a message that, and I do believe these are peace-loving people who run our government, we've been sending a message that, look, we're not going to do anything. And so they keep pushing.
Senator Talent, I keep seeing chatter online about possibly bringing back the draft. Some people think it's inevitable and others say that could never happen. What's your view?
I don't think it could ever happen, and I don't think it should happen, because I don't think it's really feasible now. Remember, we have a very mature, very high-level, sophisticated volunteer military. So these are highly trained people. I mean, there isn't really any such thing as a grunt anymore, right? So with a draft, what you do is, you put people through basic training for about, 10 weeks, 12 weeks. And then you sign him up for 2 years. Well, by the time that 2 years is up, you basically just trained him up to do what you need him to do. So barring something, obviously, anything can happen, right? But I just don't think that is consistent with the military we've built. And I'm not running down the quality of our, draftees when we were drafting people. Some of them, they were by and large a really good force once we trained them up. But no, I don't think that's the answer. I don't think the military needs to be a lot bigger. We need a lot more ships. And so we're going to need more sailors. I think the Army ought to be 10 or 15% bigger than it is. But the problem is mostly recapitalizing the force. In other words, getting the new modern ships, planes, track vehicles that we need, because the defense industrial base has shrunk to the point that we can't produce it quickly. So really, we need to build up the defense industrial base. Does that make any sense?
Oh, absolutely.
And when we're looking at things like the Navy, Jim, how much are we talking, like, from a strategic standpoint? Because I hear people talk about this Navy versus that Navy, and I don't know if any of them know what they're talking about, but I know that you do. It's more about advancement, like the advanced technology and the types of ships, right? Like the tonnage, how big and powerful they are, as opposed to just the raw number, right?
No, numbers matter a lot, too.
Okay.
Because one of the Navy's missions is presence. Remember I was saying you have signal your resolution, right? Well, you have to have ships for ships to be present. We had 560 ships under Reagan. We got about half that many now, a smaller number than since before World War I. So we do need more numbers. But you're also right. I mean, we need the high-quality platforms. Now, you ask the strategic value of them. So one of the areas where we're still way ahead of China is the undersea domain, okay, submarines. Our attack submarines are quite possibly the deadliest conventional platforms in the world. If we had more of them, now how does that affect China's calculations if they're thinking about a blockade of Taiwan? We don't have enough of them. And too many of the ones we have are laid up for maintenance. We got about 35 to 40% of the fleet that's laid up for maintenance. That's twice as much as we should have at any given time. So again, a lot of it is the industrial base. We do need to produce more numbers. I mean, again, if you got 15 minutes sometime, we can talk about the right numbers for the Navy. I tell you what, I'll get you a real navalist. I'll get you a – you guys want to do an interview in the Navy?
Sure.
I'll get you some people. There's a guy named Jerry Hendricks who's a good friend of mine. He's one of the best navalists in the country. He and I have written articles together. And I'll get you Jerry. I'll book Jerry for you.
I love it. We're getting Jerry, everybody.
Hey, nice. Guys, Jim Talent's our guest booker.
I love it.
I should have called him Captain Hendricks.
I have a new producer. Jim, we appreciate it, my friend. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, guys.
All right, good questions.
Yeah, that's good information, too, to understand the difference between power and numbers, right?
Yes.
Because you can have the power to overwhelm, but if you don't have the numbers to show and be in different places at the same time, it's a different issue.
Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we have a guest in studio. Casey Long was an alderman in St. Louis, got herself into some trouble. I think she did some time, and she is back, learned her lesson, and is going to talk to us about all of that. We have some audio for you. Which ones were mine?
Billy Joel here.
Oh, yeah. So William Joel was doing a big special on, I think it's CBS, and he was ending the show with I'm the Piano Man, and he was the crowd's going crazy, and then they cut it off and went to the local news.
Live from CBS 4, this is your news now.
People are a little mad about that one.
Yeah, Mink.
So evidently what happened was the Masters was on, and the Masters took a long time, and then they did a feature during the Masters.
And
because they did that feature that they didn't anticipate, all the local news had to pop out 2 minutes early.
Does anyone else feel like the song Piano Man when they're like, sing us a song, you're the piano man? Like, it comes across
a little bossy.
Bossy and aggressive. It's always bothered me.
Yeah, maybe they were drunk.
imagine you're just trying to play the piano at the bar and all these drunk people are like, sing us a song.
Like, that's what I'm doing, a-hole.
Hello.
Leave me alone.
I'm here for.
And then, Dave, you have another piece of audio.
Boy, this one's rough. And I don't feel bad for the girl because she made her own bed, but I do feel bad because I have a daughter who's a freshman in college. This girl is in college at Indiana State, and for some God unknown reason, she decided to give this take to the world.
If you're black, you're not country. I don't care. And I wish I meant that in the nicest way. But like, babe, I know you were raised in the country, or you're grandparents were, I guess. Your great granny and grandpas, but they was picking, okay? They wasn't planting. Just keep that in mind. They wasn't making money. They was getting sold for money. Yay, country.
Yikes.
Told ya.
Big
My
yikes.
Goodness. Yeah,
I don't feel good. Bad for her at all.
No.
She deserves whatever happens.
Valuable lesson. Don't be a
That girl's
lot
life
of things.
Will never be the same.
No.
Yeah, because she decided to be a racist on the internet, and she did it willingly. Like,
yeah.
That's the thing.
She
it's like
it
she recorded
there.
Herself and put it out there. You are choosing your path in life at that point.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen when you do that? It's do people at Big are like, you know what? She's smart. She's got a point.
It's a great. That's
nobody's
going to
say. Nobody's going to say
you
that.
Nailed it. You said what everyone's thinking.
It's a great point because it's like you want lots of when you post on the internet, you want lots of people to see it. That's why you're posting it. So, like, I guess she thought like the greater, I don't know, the greater public opinion would be like, man. Yeah, I never thought of it like that.
And what is your agenda other than racism? Is it to protect country music? Is it to put black people in their place?
Yeah, we got to make sure we save country music.
That'll show Beyonce.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
We have time for one more if we do it very quickly. This is Wheels has some audio here.
Which one is it?
You have Trump and then you have Alpha
audio. Let's do that. So this is from the quote, unbreakable man experience. It's a boot camp to teach people how to be an alpha. So picture this when you're hearing the noises you're about to hear. There's a trainer, a guy that's in charge, all in black, not wearing shoes for some reason, on a dirt road. And he is challenging a smaller dude with, you know, who's there to learn how to be a man to push him backwards. So all this you're hearing is that process.
I'm strong. Move forward. Move forward. Move forward.
I'm a
move
man.
Forward.
I am. Move forward. I am a man. I am a man. I am a man.
Forward.
I am a man.
Move forward.
I am a man.
Move forward.
I am a man.
Move forward.
I am a man.
Okay, so.
Yikes.
So. The person yelling move forward is the trainer. The person yelling I am a man is the guy pushing him.
Figured that one.
So the whole point of this, right, and there's text on the video, the whole point of this is like he's releasing his inner manhood.
Yes,
that
he is.
He's asserting himself as a man while the man training him is letting him win.
Right.
He is literally letting him win.
Right.
And the guy's screaming, I'm a man. And I think it bothers me is it's a con game. The guy is letting him win. You're not teaching someone anything when you're letting them win.
It reminds me of when Michael Scott yells, I declare bankruptcy. It's like, that doesn't mean that you've actually declared bankruptcy.
Well, he's a man now. Welcome back, guys. DJ Esslin, KMOX 235. So my guest in studio is Casey Long, former alderwoman in St. Louis, the youngest person ever elected to the Board of Aldermen. She's with us now. Very nice to meet you. Great talking with you on the break there. Really interesting conversations.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. I'm so excited about being here with you today.
Yeah. So we have mutual friends. Jeff Smith's a good buddy of ours and a good buddy of yours. And part of the reason you know him is you got yourself into some trouble when you were an alderman. And you have embraced it and you love talking about it and the whole concept of second chances. So just tell us your story.
Absolutely.
Take it any way you want it to go.
Yeah, so, you know, here in St. Louis, we recently celebrated the opening day with the Cardinals. There's a lot of great things happening with it being spring. I don't know about you guys, but I'm just super excited, ready for good weather, ready for pork steaks, all of the summer stuff. But here during the month of April, there's something that many people may not know about. It's actually called Second Chance Month. And what it is a public awareness campaign to raise awareness about the barriers that people experience post-release from prison. So many people don't know, but there are like about 48,000 documented barriers that people who've already served time in prison, they experience with getting access to education, housing, jobs, employment. So I'm here to talk about that. And I'm also here to share about just my own personal story of someone who was able to make it because of second chances, because the community here in St. Louis didn't give up on me even after I made a very, very critical mistake as an elected official.
Yeah, walk me through your mistake. And I'm really interested because you seem like such a lovely person. Like, well, Casey never did anything wrong. Like, walk me through your decisions.
Yeah, so that's what I think is really important. I think that a lot of times we think of people who have been in prison, they must be bad. You know, they must be like these horrible people to have created or been convicted of some type of crime. But yeah, I embezzled campaign funds, something that I'm certainly not proud about, have apologized profusely. I continue to apologize to this day. But just walking back a little bit, almost 14 years ago, I made history here in the city of St. Louis as an alderwoman. I represented what was then the 6th Ward. Boundaries have been changed since then, but my areas that I represented included some Southside neighborhoods, also downtown West. This area was actually part of my aldermanic district. Did a lot of great work publicly. Privately, my life was spiraling out of control. Just really made a stupid decision to embezzle funds from my campaign account. I wanted to keep up. I wanted to have a certain type of clothes. Just a lot of insecurity inwardly, and really had an encounter with God. That's the only way that I can explain it. Had an encounter with God, and God said, you know what, Casey, you need to admit that you've been embezzling these campaign funds. I said, God, if I admit that I've been embezzling these campaign funds, I'm going to go to prison. I did not hear God say that you won't go to prison, but I heard him say that I am going to be with you. So I made the decision to admit that I had been embezzling these funds, resigned. Very public scandal, super embarrassed, disappointed my family, disappointed my constituents. But since then, after, you know, resigning from that position, I actually ended up starting a business, a sewing ministry, which I run now in Florissant, Missouri. And I'm a third generation seamstress. And so what we do is we have a place where people come in and they learn how to sew, in the process of creating programs for people coming out of prison. So I say all of this. My story is that I didn't go to prison. I should have. I say by the grace of God, I didn't go. But I understand that 1 in 3 Americans, so y'all, that's 1 in 3 folk, have some form of criminal record. And despite what they may have done, we're all in need of second chances. We all need mercy. After we've served our time, you know, paid all the consequences, we all need to be able to have access to education, access to jobs, access to careers, so we can become productive citizens in our community.
Let me ask you, Casey, for people who have done time, is it the laws that are stacked against them, or are the laws okay? It's just that people are kind of stacked against them.
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. So, and one of the great things about second chance awareness is heightening awareness, that a lot of times I think we think that people who have committed crimes, we just kind of wipe them off our hands and say, well, they did the crime. They deserve the time. So one is letting people know that these are mothers, brothers. Hey, they're people like me. You know, good people who just made a mistake. So raising awareness about that, but also talking to legislators as well, that there are some significant barriers, like being able to access social services, being able to access housing. You know, we live in the show me state. We want to be able to see that people have made a change. But in order to be able to do so, we really got to stop stepping on the necks of people who have come out of prison. It's almost like, Dave, a second type of incarceration, a permanent prison, where if you've been incarcerated, you know, there are these barriers that are present, which make it difficult for you to really be a productive member of society.
What would Casey have thought of this conversation 2 years before he got in trouble?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that, like many people who have committed crimes, you don't think that it's going to happen to you. You think that you're smarter. You think that somehow you're more powerful. You think that you will never get caught. So the idea of even committing a crime was something that it never crossed my mind. And I think that that's a lot of people. People do not wake up one day, or people do not enter into this world saying, you know what? I'm going to go to prison. You know, people don't, I don't think people plan, you know, for prison. I think that, you know, decisions happen and circumstances happen. And I think if we're honest, we've all have broken the law, maybe not to the point of going to prison, but all of us have broken the law at some point. Maybe we just haven't gotten caught.
Yeah.
And we all can understand the benefit of giving a or having a second chance and someone extending mercy to us.
And we were talking on the break. I want to bring this up, too, that I have never been in trouble with the law, but I've certainly done things that I'm ashamed of, deeply ashamed of. That makes you want to go away. And we talked about the importance of people refusing to go away. It's one thing to be punished. It's one thing to pay a debt to society. But once you have, you really, like yourself and Jeff and everyone else, you have to think enough of yourself to say, my instinct is to go hide. And I know that that's what you want me to do, but I'm still alive. I'm still a human being. I paid my debt to society and I need to live a life.
Yeah, that is so revelatory for you to say that. And that's the type of compassion and what I believe the whole concept of this Second Chance Month is about, just being able to connect with people who may not have gone to prison, but understand the type of shame and guilt and maybe even, you know, regret those that have been, you know, convicted of a crime may feel. And I went through that myself. Statistics let us know that there are about 70 million Americans that have been released from prison but are impacted by these barriers. So that's 70 million folk. They're in our families. They're in our communities. And we are raising awareness to advocate and to let people know that they have a voice. I mean, you don't have to live in shame. You do not have to shrink back. But you can fully be yourself and tell your story.
Well, you telling your story certainly helps people. It puts a different face on it because we think of all groups being monolithic now because we just don't have time to get to know each other. So these people are like that. These people are like that. People who've been in trouble with the law, they're like that. And it's a big order, but one thing we need to do is stop thinking in terms of groups and thinking in terms of people, I think.
Yeah, and that's why I'm really grateful for the Prison Fellowship, which is the largest nonprofit organization that sponsored Second Chance Month. And so because of their work, they're really putting a face on advocacy and letting people know that those who commit crimes, they're our neighbors. Mm-hmm. They are us. They are our family members. They are our children. We're not bad people. We just made a mistake.
If there are people out there who are in your position or people who are in the position to help someone who is in your position, what would you suggest they do? Are there resources, websites? What do people do?
Sure. So there are a lot of events taking place for Second Chance Month. And as a Christian, we believe that, you know, the church should be at the forefront, that's the entire message of Christianity, of extending grace and extending mercy. So there are churches that are hosting Second Chance services throughout our city. Also, if people want to get involved and learn more about Second Chance Month, you can go to prisonfellowship.org. There's great opportunities for advocacy and advocating for those who are in need of second chances.
Lovely to meet you. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
251 DGS on KMOX. So we know that tens of thousands of years ago, well, millions of years ago, up to about 40,000 years ago, there were animals and insects that were just crazy big.
Yeah.
And I understand some of that, why it is, but most of it I don't. They're just crazy big. The giant sloths and the Gigantopithecus and all these kinds of things. Want to hear a really cool one?
Yes.
Up to 40,000 years ago, there were three species of giant kangaroo that if they stood all the way up would have been just under 7 feet and weigh 375 pounds.
Dude!
And they were jacked.
Well, I mean, even modern kangaroos, yeah. I mean, you ever see them when they flex?
Plus, they want to fight all the time.
Dude, they're mean.
Yeah. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
Very terrifying.
Oh, my God. That'd be so cool to see, though.
So,
and they're everywhere down there. Like, they're like pests. They're like worse than
right.
deer.
Now, one thing I don't know how long people have been in Australia. But I'm going to guess they were there 40,000 years ago.
40,000? Well, I mean, at some point, right? The aboriginals would have been there. Yeah.
So our people had to go out and dig up a bunch of tuber roots and worry about 400-pound kangaroos.
65,000. So, yeah, they were there fighting.
So they overlapped.
They
showed up and stayed for 15,000 years until these guys were gone.
Good thing kangaroos don't eat people.
Yeah, maybe, you know what? Maybe they were just a really great food source for us.
I mean, they also, but they would, I mean, they were hard to handle if they were mad at you, if you encroached on their territory or whatever. But still.
Wow. We found an animal that Kevin doesn't think he can beat up.
Kangaroo? No.
What about a modern kangaroo?
No.
Mono.
No.
Nope.
No, I mean, like, you've seen the video, or you've heard the stories.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
what about a
guy
little
saves
jelly?
Guy saves his dog. I probably do that because I'm an idiot. But no, if you're like, would you want to fight a kangaroo? No.
No. Listen to me. Because you just described the video where the guy.
What?
Yeah. Well, no, it's just he just described the video where the guy, like, protects his dog from the kangaroo or whatever. That video, that kangaroo goes down on one punch. You can take a kangaroo.
No.
Then the kangaroo showed up at his house.
Dude,
no,
really?
I'm not kidding.
I mean, I'm not messing. Dude.
How did he get his address?
Dude, he followed him.
Here's the thing.
Kangaroo had a friend at the DMV searched his license plate number.
They don't fight with their little arms. Right, they lean back on their tail and they kick you, and they can jump like 20 feet in the air. So they're strong. They will kill you with
20 feet in the
look
air.
It up. Look it up, brother.
He's so mad at you right now.
That's look bananas.
How high can a kangaroo jump? Why am I typing so slowly?
All right.
Yeah, they it's can, like 6 feet.
No. They can jump 30 to 40 feet in distance. They can jump straight up 12 feet.
That's still pretty crazy.
That's strong.
Pretty high.
Yeah.
Higher than I can
do. We're having the strangest
It's the best,
fights.
Isn't it?
Especially between Wheeler and Andrew.
I know. I especially
it's always
love
about
that,
science-y stuff, too.
That Andrew is fighting with Wheeler and telling him, like, you can do it. You can. And, like, somehow it's causing conflict between the two of them.
But we had one earlier off the air where, no, I think it was on the air, where Amy was like, well, you know, a lot of people like Christian nationalists, they think that God, they know that God can use not great people. He's done it in the past many times. And Kevin's like, why didn't he just use good people? And Amy's like, well, again, in scripture.
They use it. And then I'm like, yeah, that's right.
And
they,
I'm like,
in there, it's in there.
This is going nowhere good.
It's in there.
This is not going to end anytime.
It's in the book.
Soon.
It's in the book.
It is.
Sometimes God uses bad people who can jump 12 feet in the air.
And fight kangaroos.
Show up at your house?
Show up at your
somehow.
House.
Somehow. I mean, I'm impressed that they made it there.
Man.
Honey, there's a really jacked kangaroo.
The lesson in this is be careful of kangaroos.